Welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. This is the podcast where we explore the people and stories that make up the tech and venture ecosystem. Don't forget to subscribe, like, rate, and share the podcast because it really helps us get the word out to more people who are curious about understanding even more about the world of venture capital. This season of Nothing Ventured is sponsored by Odin. Odin helps angels, VCs, and founders to raise and deploy capital seamlessly. You can structure your SPVs and now run your funds, handle capital calls, portfolio management more smoothly and easily in one place. Founders use Odin to raise their entire round in a few clicks by simply sending investors a link and receiving investments immediately. Odin works with over 5,000 investors and over 150 emerging fund managers and angel syndicates globally. Head to joinodin.com to learn more. That's joinodin.com. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. In today's episode, I spoke to Duncan Clark. Duncan is co-founder and CEO of Flourish, a platform with a mission of empowering everyone to tell compelling and engaging stories with data, acquired by Australian giant Canva in 2021. Duncan is now Europe lead at Canva, where he continues to deliver on Flourish's core mission from within the Canva suite of products, whilst also helping drive Canva's growth across the continent. In today's episode, we talked about building things that don't scale in the first place, taking optional capital rather than existential capital, dealing with multiple acquisition offers and ultimately choosing Canva, as well as having a business card pressed in his hand after a pitch from the founder of Founder Collective. Let's get straight into it. Duncan, really great to have you here in the studio with me today. For the audience, if you want to learn a little bit more about Duncan's background, what he did to build Flourish Duncan, great to have you here in the studio with me. Really appreciate your time.
Great to be here.
So for the audience, if you want to learn a little bit more about Duncan's background, do check out the Primer episode. He talks about what drove him to create Flourish and told us a bit about what's in store for Canva in the future. In the meantime, let's dive straight in. You built Flourish from within Founders Factory, very strong friend of the podcast, and certainly I have a lot of fond memories. In fact, I think we may have been at Founders Factory at the same time, right in the early days, sort of 2015 and 16. But you only ever raised sort of £1 million pounds, I assume, thereafter. So can you talk me through the complexity of building a business to profitability and then, on top of that, having a very successful exit, especially in the context of the current fundraising market, where I know that a lot of founders are really struggling with this question?
Yeah, I think a lot of businesses are struggling with it after years and years of no one really caring about profitability. I think it is really, you know, post tech market adjustment, it's become totally front of mind for everyone. I grew up in Yorkshire, so I've always sort of had a natural tightness. And for me, like getting to profitability early was something we really wanted to do. So I don't know, the way it worked for us, I guess, is that we had quite a particular sort of transition into that. Because we started out making kind of bespoke projects and actually making visualizations more on a consultancy basis, then we were able to sort of gradually turn the dial from consultancy to product. And that meant that we didn't need to get to the unit economics of, you know, we're selling this thing for $20 a month. Shit, we need 300,000 subscribers to break even. So we did it in a slightly, a slightly unusual way, that we would take customers who would come in for consultancy services, and when we would, because they already had budget, we would be able to work with them, turn them into software companies. And they saw the benefits, they were pleased. That would then, they'd become a repeat customer. And then, of course, also that looks great for your next sales deck or your next kind of fundraise if you're able to show these big logos.
I mean, it kind of comes back to that old adage, do things that don't scale, right? So you essentially built the business off the back of an agency model, which, as we all know, and as I certainly know, is not the most scalable of business models, although they can scale, and eked out the kind of software as a service part from the consultancy. Would that be a fair way?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think there's that particular thing where if you've got a big business, great logo coming to you with pre-allocated budget, and they say, we've got this budget and here's what we need. In a way, that's an absolute dream for a new software company, because you can say, sure, we can take that budget. We can give you more than you wanted. And by the way, we're going to end up getting that budget every year now from now on in. So it can be a real win-win. Obviously, it's a massive trap as well. I mean, one of the great challenges of doing that is having the discipline not to get stuck in the consultancy model.
Yeah.
And in fact, we went into Founders Factory really in order to force ourselves to have that discipline, because we had this, you know, perfectly functioning consultancy small business, and we thought, well, it's going to be really hard to turn down interesting, well-paying products, projects, unless we give ourselves a framework. So we went into Founders Factory for 6 months. We kind of promised ourselves that we would, and them, that we would take no more consultancy work at that point. Wow. And then consultancy work that came in, we would say, well, how do we turn this into a software kind of sale? And also, how can we learn from this customer who's come to us, like what they need and what they want, so that we could really start to see what does this new space look like? That currently there's not a tool for it, but we're making one. So how can we make sure that we're meeting the needs of the people we know want it?
It's interesting. We had Matt Johns on the podcast several weeks ago. Matt sort of actually came from a music background to some extent. His father passed away, I think, quite early in his late teens, and he took over the music business, and then he over time sort of added in technology into that business and then sold it as more of a technology business than a pure music business. It was completely offline prior to that, and then built Founders and Lightning, which is his current sort of business to some extent, but it's a sort of fund plus agency model where they build tech for non-technical founders in often non-technical product sets or business sets, right? So it's taking the things that do scale and scaling those rather than trying to scale the whole kind of consultancy business, right? Like it's very difficult to look at the whole suite of things you do and say, okay, how do we productize the whole thing? It's actually which parts of it can be productized and which parts of it can be productized and resold on a regular basis.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And of course, and the other sort of key thing, if you're trying to get to profitability, is what is the most scalable mechanism for growth? And, you know, in the many VC-backed companies, it's just pouring dollars down the drain on marketing, which, sure, it's going to give you something back, but are you ever going to be able to balance the books? So, I mean, for us, we had this very particular way of approaching that, which is that, you know, our background and our passion was all about digital journalism and data journalism. So we took the sort of slightly counterintuitive decision at the beginning that we were going to give Flourish, at least a version of Flourish, free to all newsrooms. They could apply and we would give it to them. We'd still have our logo on there. It wouldn't be quite the full suite, but we would give it to, in a sense, what were our most obvious target audience. And that worked really well for us.
It's also not a bad marketing.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. If you get, okay, use our product for free and just, you know, have it in your newspapers with hundreds of thousands of readers, right?
Exactly. So that was really our sort of secret source on the kind of
it was the flywheel.
Viral marketing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So we, pretty early on, I think, you know, we were getting to 1 billion views of Flourish graphics a day.
Incredible.
Because if you're on a really high traffic news website and you're on the front page, I mean, that's where the traffic is. And of course, that went even crazier during COVID because the whole world was sat around pressing refresh on the page of the newspaper site that had the map of the COVID charts, the map of the COVID outbreak and the charts showing the same thing. So yeah, that thing of, you know, you need to find a way to reach the audience you need to reach without paying through the nose for it, which is simple to say, but it probably looks different for every company.
I mean, to be really blunt, I mean, in this environment, more and more businesses are having to figure out how to scale efficiently and how to scale profitably. And in fact, there's been quite a lot of press out there. We talked about this on a live podcast I did just a week or so ago, where, as an example, Gil Dimner from Angular Ventures has written a piece in Medium where he simply states, we will be backing companies at seed stage that can grow profitably without having to go through the kind of venture factory of Series A, Series B, Series C. Not that they won't ever take additional capital on, but whether they do or don't will be much more, much less around, we need the money to scale, or rather much more around, we need the money to scale rather than we need the money to figure out how to get to scale.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, I think the sort of discipline that is forced on a company of not being overcapitalized is just really, really healthy. And you can learn a lot by trying to get to profitability in the seed stage, which of course now is what everyone is kind of having to aim for.
Everyone is. I mean, I think the flip side of that, and we'll come to this on the next question a little bit, is also understanding your investors, right? So when I raised capital on one of the businesses that I try to launch, after the 2 years that I ran that business, I realized very clearly that I'm the wrong sort of person to take on capital. I've been through kind of building small businesses almost all my life. And actually, I quite enjoy being in control of what I'm doing. And obviously, once you bring an investor on, that can be very difficult. So you were backed by Founder Collective and Local Globe. I'd love to get your thoughts on finding the right VC and what a founder VC fit actually means in reality, because occasionally or even often for a lot of founders, it's really about what's the term sheet in front of me and do I need to make payroll in the next 2 weeks and should I therefore take the cash? But what are some of the key considerations that you would tell founders to think about?
So I think don't underestimate just chemistry. Like if you really instinctively like someone and get on with them, you can imagine being in a call with them in a stressful, difficult situation. Like that counts for a lot. Mm. And so the way our raise worked, I actually was pitching as one of the rising stars at Founders Forum. Mm. And David Frankel from Founders Collective was just the person after me on the stage. And as I walked off the stage, he sort of pressed his business card into my hand and said, this looks awesome, I want to do it. And so we kind of avoided going around and pitching to lots of people and getting into that kind of almost like a sort of factory-like mindset about how you're doing it. And,
or essentially the beauty parade, right?
Like yeah, exactly, yeah. And which also can, I think, you know, and I had a bit of experience this later on, can be a bit unhealthy, like rather than just saying, this feels good, we're going to do it, it becomes almost more like a kind of, you know, everyone trying to play off against each other, which sets up a slightly different dynamic at the beginning of a relationship. But then I think the other thing is the sort of philosophical alignment. And this has probably altered a lot since we were thinking about this, but one of the things that made me kind of very keen to work with Founder Collective is that they have a kind of very rational approach to like what a business is. They've never been growth at all costs. They produce these sort of hilarious stickers around, you know, VC, cash, tread with care kind of thing. And so they are quite atypical of VCs in that they're quite openly cautious about, you know, the way that the VC world has been for quite a long time. So that felt like a sort of philosophical alignment. And I think that's really important because I think, and again, this has probably changed a bit since, but the thing you don't want to be is in a position where you've got kind of an exit that works brilliantly for you practically,
but not
financially, but most importantly, in terms of what you want. Like, you know, you might be that the company that you've always admired the most wants to acquire you, but your VCs are saying, well, that's not a big enough deal. So I think sort of almost having that conversation up front, like,
Are we on the same path?
Do
we have the same objectives?
Exactly.
Mind,
yeah. And yeah. Also, I think reputation counts for a lot there because like a really good seed stage VC fund is really not going to, like one with a really good reputation is really going to be going out of their way to avoid blocking a founder doing something what they want, whereas someone who's a, you know, a bit more of a kind of
tourist VC,
exactly. So I think that reputation counts for a lot as well, but it can't hurt to be explicit and you know, discuss what the different options for the future.
Yeah,
and of course that's a delicate balance because part of pitching to VCs is about coming across as just so absolutely certain that you're going to take over the whole world. But I think the smarter, more thoughtful VCs, they know that, you know, there are various different ways it can go. And often the most exciting and attractive route won't be the one where you end up as a unicorn. Mm. So I don't know, openness, chemistry, and kind of philosophical alignment, I guess I'd say.
Yeah, I think the chemistry one is super important. We had someone on the podcast who I remember said, you know, the average VC founder relationship lasts longer than the average UK marriage, which is kind of worrying, but equally like very intense, I think. And again, to your point, right, you are going to go through good times and bad times, most likely. You want to make sure that the person that's sitting around the table giving you direction is able to empathize with what that means and can help you through that rather than sort of just be hammering at you, why aren't you hitting the metrics? I think, and equally on the philosophy, and this kind of comes back to what I was saying about when I raised money, fortunately, all of the angels that I had on my cap table were incredible individuals. You know, all, I think, I might be wrong, I haven't asked them explicitly, but I think all of them would probably back me again if I were to ask, but I never would. I think is the reality of where I'm at. Because philosophically, they were aligned both with what I was trying to do, but also they understood who I was and what I was doing and the way that I would operate, right? So there was very clear, you know, they very clearly knew what they were getting into, rather than either being pitched the dream or vice versa and promise the world, or vice versa, where the investor says, yeah, we can bring all of this to the table and we'll follow you for the next, you know, 13 rounds. You know, it was very clear to me what they would and wouldn't end up doing and what parts of the journey they could be part of and what parts of the journey they would struggle with. So I think that's really important. And I think the point right now, again, as markets continue to be kind of tight, VCs, I think, would not in public say that they're struggling, but some of them may well be. Certainly publicly, you know, on Twitter and other places, you're starting to hear stories of, you know, there's one I read recently, a VC asked for their money back. Maybe they'd invested under a safe or a non-equity instrument, because otherwise I couldn't quite figure out how they'd be able to do that. But, you know, that's kind of a shock to the system. LPs not funding VCs, which means VCs are going slower, et cetera, et cetera. And equally, I think founders having to really wake up to the realization that very few businesses get funded by venture capital, right? Very few businesses. And therefore, if you do not fit the criteria for that fund, or vice versa, it's probably better to walk away, even if there is a term sheet in front of you, right? So, I think that's super valuable. So I think moving on to kind of the journey from Flourish into Canva, as it were, I'd love to understand how you got on their radar. Because, you know, given that you had acquisition interest from other people that were courting you, how did you decide that Canva were the right fit? And I'd love for you to talk us through the stages that you went through from initial interest to the deal closing and give us an idea of kind of the speed in the process.
So, as you say, we'd had acquisition interest before from a couple of different companies. And they were sort of serious approaches, and we took them seriously. But I think what we found as we kind of considered them and sort of chatted to them was that it just didn't feel that exciting. It didn't feel like, you know, we hadn't, you know, neither of us had ever been really fundamentally very money motivated. Like selling to a company that we felt had a less exciting vision than ours just didn't seem like it was a good move for life, really. So,
and was your expectation, sorry to interrupt, was your expectation that you would be going with the company, i.e. the exit would always include you then?
Yeah, I think with a sort of like an early, very technical product company, that's kind of almost a given.
Yeah.
And so we turned them down but having seriously thought about it, just because it kind of felt wrong ultimately. And then I guess the other thing that made us sort of cautious of it was at least in one case, you get kind of a big company, you get approached by the kind of corp dev person or whatever, and then they start talking about, you know, we're interested in exploring a partnership, we have an investment wing, and we could just have an integration,
and then we'll talk about acquisition down the track. Yeah,
yeah, we'll have, but or not at
or
all.
Or not. Yeah.
Like, and this weird dance where everyone involved in the conversation knows that this is an acquisition conversation, but there's a real reluctance to just be explicit and transparent. And again, goes back to that thing about, you know, work with VCs you trust who you can just instinctively get on with. And I found that a bit like the same with the kind of potential acquisition conversations where I just thought, this isn't how I work. This isn't like how, this seems like too much bullshit involved. Mm. And so we actually decided, okay, well, let's forget all that and go and do a Series A round. And so we were actually in the middle of doing that when we heard from Canva. And I think we were just on their radar because they were interested in data storytelling. As I said before, we're very kind of visible due to the way we work with newsrooms. I mean, I still get pinged by someone in Canva's based in Sydney. So I still get pinged by someone every couple of weeks saying, oh, I just saw the Flourish logo on the Sydney Morning Herald or whatever. And we're kind of quite visible in that space. And I just got a ping from Rob, the head of product, who's become a great friend and colleague of mine. And just saying that they were interested to chat. And one of the things that just made it feel very different for me was just the fact that it was proper, open, kind of honest, straightforward communication. And that immediately put it in a different category from the others. But then it only took a few calls for me to feel just completely bought in, because very quickly I had chatted to Mel and Cliff, the first two original founders, really got on with them. And I also quickly understood that this was a company that, although it had scaled to several thousand people, still had that energy and buzz of a sort of founder-led startup.
Yeah, got it.
So that was really important for me. And then another thing was we were just talking about profitability. Canva's been profitable for 6-7 years. So we sort of bonded.
I can't remember, have they taken any capital?
Yeah, it's done several raises over the years, but it's never really been existential. It's always been sort of optional.
Yeah.
And so that we sort of bonded over the way that we'd run the businesses, which was really nice. But then the other sort of crucial thing for me, which is really unique to Canva, is the fact that Canva is now a third owned by charity. So it's this incredible startup growth story. But one of the things that it is public information, but it isn't very widely understood yet, is that Mel and Cliff actually gave almost all their equity to a charitable trust, which means that a third of all the value that you create in the Canva universe is going directly to eliminating extreme poverty and universal education and the other aims. So that just felt like such a different category of thing. That's how I'd kind of always seen what we were doing in some sense, without ever kind of formalizing it in that way. So it all just fitted very neatly together. And then I guess the other thing is, sometimes you get big companies, they set up a corp dev department, and then they kind of acquire, not exactly for the sake of it, but it's kind of...
Yeah, it's almost building up an IP asset.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, asset bank. Yeah.
And so and you can very much end up in a situation where I've read other sort of startup stories where you can end up in a situation where the company's been acquired, but there's not actually a very natural fit.
Well, it's the buy and kill, right? Like Facebook was very famous for doing this.
Exactly. Exactly. And or just no one's really thought it through well enough to think, could it actually integrate? Maybe you want it to, but you don't know. And with Canva, we had just this extremely neat fit, because they had our Series A pitch was basically, we've already nailed data visualization and storytelling on the web publishing, marketers, newsrooms. The next step is to take it into a more work suites type use case. That means adding more presentation capability, making it more of a kind of document and work suite tool. And of course, when we started chatting to Canva, it was like, oh, we don't need to build all that. Canva's built all that, and they've got 100 million users. So, so let's not worry about that bit. We'll keep focusing on the bit that we're really expert in. Canva haven't even started on that, so it's really good fit from their perspective as
well. Yeah, so just straight integration rather than trying to Frankenstein it into an existing half-built product or something along those lines. Amazing. And what was the time frame, sort of start to finish?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. The bit that's kind of relevant is just the decision making was super quick. And I think that Cliff, the COO and co-founder of Canva, is extremely sort of decisive and fast moving, and sort of I think has developed a really good reputation for just being a sort of honest, fast moving, straightforward
straight shooter.
Exactly. So yeah, that bit flew by. And then obviously in any acquisition there's a kind of certain amount of due dil and admin and all the rest, but I think the fact that it was obviously going to be quite quick was another thing that made it feel like right landing for us.
It certainly sounds like you've landed on your feet, as it were, in the sense that not from the perspective of the exit or whatever, financial outcome there was for you, but it sounds like for the enthusiasm that you kind of have for it, that it's the right place for where you are right now in your life and where you wanted to be. So, I think kudos and congratulations. I think lots of founders would probably struggle to be as positive where they have been acquired, and often those tend to be quite negative stories or stories that are never told, often because of various clauses in the contracts and so on. But now that Flourish is part of the Canva family, it'd be great to understand, and you've already talked about it a little bit, but from your perspective, what has been Canva's key to success? And thinking about the values and mission you talked about, obviously the philanthropic side and the charitable side, but the founding relationship, the metrics that they pursue, what is it that you think has really made them such a massive success?
So I think the things that have really driven Canva's amazing success are I mean, there's several things. I think being a values first company really helps. I think like Mel, Cliff, Cam, and then the early team they hired and then the people they brought in after, it's always been around this quite clearly established set of values. It's very, very mission driven. It's never felt internally, at least not since I've been there, and I'm sure this goes back to the beginning, that the aim is to make money principally. Mm. And I think that's a thing that like all good companies have in common, that any commercial success,
the purpose goes,
sure, you're
that.
Driving towards it, but it's not why you're doing it. And Canva really feels like that. It feels like a company that it was set up around a big, exciting vision. Mm. The vision was so kind of all encompassing and open that it's something that you could get to, you know, a huge hundreds and millions of users and still be working towards it. I mean, Mel, you know, at the end of every big talk always says, you know, we're only 1% of the way there. And that idea that you can just keep growing around this seed is really important. So I think, yeah, the values, the kind of sense of a kind of undying mission. And I think also for Canva, the democratization aspect. So that whole thing about empowering the whole world to design, which, as I say, you know, it's gone from being more individuals to more people in teams and companies. And but if you take that quite literally as Canva has done, then it moves things in slightly unexpected ways. So for example, most American companies, you know, they're doubling down on the American market first.
Yeah.
Canva, based out in Sydney, you know, one of the first things it did as part of that Empower the World to Design is start putting Canva's editor into multiple languages.
Interesting.
And not just the editor, but of course all the content, the templates, the tagging on the images, the search terms. So Canva was in 100 languages, you know, probably about a similar time that Facebook was. Mm. And it means that it's had this incredible global spread with huge audiences in India and Brazil and China and all over the world. And so it's that combination of like a true mission-driven company where the mission is about empowerment, which means making things easy, but the mission is also about the global spread, which means making it kind of accessible all over the world. And it's all of those things together as just being this kind of feedback loop of viral product-led growth. And so I think, yeah, it's probably all of those things. And I guess now it's, you know, the next stage for Canva is taking all of that success around that engine and attaching it to AI, attaching it to big company use cases and really going wall to wall inside enterprises.
Yeah. And I think on top of that, it goes back to, you know, something you said earlier, that it still feels like a founder led business, right? Even though it is scaled to thousands of employees and, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of users and revenues, you know, it doesn't feel like you are part of a corporate machine, I guess, right?
By the sounds
of things, it's still a very open. And just like talk me through kind of what the European sort of arm of Canva, which you head up essentially, what does that look like? Why was it so critical to have that in place and kind of what do you do within that?
Yeah, so it's it was kind of counterintuitive somehow for me that when I first learned properly about Canva's sort of global spread, that although obviously it was massively widely used in the UK and the rest of Europe, there weren't really any staffers here at all. I mean, and that's partly because being HQ'd in Sydney, there is almost no time zone overlap at all. So just practically it's a complicated thing to set up a sort of outpost on the
without one of the founders either moving or whatever.
Which would be the classic thing.
Yeah.
And so I guess that was sort of slightly surprising. And I've always wondered, you know, is it a coincidence? Is it not? But I don't really know how planned it was. But what happened is Canva ended up acquiring several companies in Europe.
Ah.
And so there were image libraries like Pexels and Pixabay. There was the AI company.
I did not realize that Canva bought out Pixabay, but okay, yeah.
Yep. And then there is Smart Mockups, a company doing product mockups.
Yeah. There's the Austrian one you mentioned.
The Austrian one, Kaleido, the visual AI company. So there have been several European acquisitions. And I think even that's not a coincidence, actually, in as far as American companies tend to focus on American startups. And so actually there's a lot of really great startups in Europe that don't have quite as natural a buyer. So I think, Canva did a good job of picking some great companies in Europe. And then as a result of that, ended up with a team of maybe, you know, 100 people based across the continent at first working on mostly those standalone products. And then over time, those people working more and more on the mothership product as well. And then once we had that kind of seed around which to grow, we were able to turn it more into a sort of pan-European organization. So now we have, you know, a Canva sales team, a Canva marketing team, a Canva legal team, all based in the London office. We've got round the sun security. We've got, you know, all the other sort of ops and supporting functions. In addition to these, you know, various product teams who really came out of the acquisition. So these days, yeah, we're probably heading for 250 people in Europe. We've got our big new office in Hoxton Square, which is really great, kind of fun, vibey kind of place. Vibey being the phrase that Canva used for these things.
And they are based out of Sydney.
They're based out of Sydney.
It's just a good thing they haven't, you know, gone full Bondi.
Exactly.
Vibe is just about acceptable. Yeah.
Well, the I think Canva's probably the only company in the world to have someone with a job title head of Vibe. And there was a great story behind that. It was actually the owner of a local restaurant that Mel and Cliff used to really like in the early days, and they basically asked the founder of that, "We love the vibe in this restaurant. Can you bring it into our office?" And so he did. He shut it down. He opened a kitchen in the office, and now he's in charge of sort of, you know, workplace experience and all that kind of stuff.
Wow, amazing! The globe. So not just beanbags and table tennis, ping pong tables, I guess.
No, there's lots of very foodie as well. There's a long-standing culture.
That's an Aussie thing.
Shared
for sure.
Lunch. Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Look, Duncan, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here on the podcast with me. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn. You're on Twitter. Where can they find you?
Yeah, LinkedIn these days probably would be easiest. And if you want to check out Canva, you know where to go. And Flourish at flourish.studio is a good place to go and find about all the visualizations you didn't know you could make.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.